to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
And let me introduce to Professor Jeremy Bailenson, who's at Stanford University, where he runs the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And Jeremy's work is really about the development, the psychology, and the experience of what happens now that technology makes it possible for us to be in embodied spaces that are not embodied by our actual physical selves. So what does that feel like? How does this change our social interactions? And what are the different ways that the designs of these digital renderings of ourselves, how does their design affect how we interact with each other? So happy to welcome you.
Thank you, Judith, for that introduction and also for the invitation. It must be fantastic to be spending a year here writing. So I am envious. That is great. Can you guys hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
I know this thing is loud. I tend to be pretty loud too. But with questions and answers, my style of speaking, I'm going to bombard you with about 40 studies in about 35 minutes. And my hope is to give you a really broad scope of what we do at the lab. This URL here, everything I'm going to talk about today is published and the PDFs are up there. Don't be shy about yelling out, what does this technology mean? What does that jargon mean? What's that control condition? I'm not going to give you many details about how I measured stuff and what controls are, but I'd love for you to just, I want to give you a nice breath. As we go through them, but if you don't, just ask and I'll give you more details. So the big question I'm going to address is, in a world in which one can look and behave at any way that you want, where there's no constraints of truth or physical reality, how does that change social interaction? How does that change psychology and identity? And what goes on in this world in which there are no social rules? To give you an overview of this talk, I'm going to breeze through how my technology works. Virtual reality is one of the most abused words in all of science, and I'm just going to give my definitions of how we implement VR. What my lab does is we build VR and then we run experiments on people when they're in VR. So I like to pitch myself as a very mediocre, if less than mediocre, engineer. We do build it because you can't really buy it. You've got to build it. And then a strong social scientist who runs studies on those. So I'm going to go through the technology, but really just as a mechanism to get you to my studies. I'm going to talk about my theory of transformed social interaction briefly. I'm then going to take it through lots and lots of experimental examples. And I thought for this audience in particular, it'd be useful to close by talking about, I'm going to go over some lines of studies that are really designed to raise some questions about ethics and about implications, both legal and otherwise, for people in society. So people are spending lots of time online, and we have these digital identities. These things are managed and manifested in many ways. So is there anyone in this room that I have to define Second Life for? The online world Second Life, I figure we're all clear on that here. This is the Nintendo Wii, one of the most popular video games out there, and the reason it's popular is because it allows our emotions to be naturalistic. It gets more engaging. Has anyone seen this Orville Redenbacher commercial? On the bottom left, if you have not, Google Orville Redenbacher avatar. Basically, there was enough video footage of Orville that they could pitch together all these angles and build a 3D model of him. And now you can see Orville dancing around to an iPod saying that he's, you know, Megs are important than popcorn with weight. Basically, he never gave any permission to do this, but we've rebuilt him and we are animating him to do stuff. And then this is kind of the traditional way that people think about virtual reality. You wear a head-mounted display, you see a digital world. In this room, how many of you guys have worn a head-mounted display and been in any immersive VR? Okay, good. So we'll talk about that. When you think about an avatar, we're often thinking about this guy here in the bottom left, that guy in the green shirt, a fully articulated 3D model. But everything I'm going to talk about today deals with your digital identity, meaning some string of ones and zeros that loosely represents you in a digital space that can be copied, emailed, tweaked, etc. So a JPEG is just a series of color values across a grid. When you talk on a cell phone, this is not your voice. This is a very mere approximation of your voice that's turned to ones and zeros and sent over networks and then rebuilt on the other side. So you can think of that as an avatar. Whenever you use video, we can pull out features about your face, features about your gesture, which really do capture aspects of your identity. And even an online profile, this loose collection of information, can be thought of as a digital identity or as an avatar. The biggest test of VR, every VR person has this in her lab or his lab, it's the pit. You put on the helmet, you look down, and you're on this chasm with a plank that you have to walk over, this rickety plank. One in three adults won't step within a meter of my plank, and one in three adults won't refuse to go on it. It's your palms sweat, your heart beats faster. When you're in these virtual worlds, it feels real, and there's a whole line of work that I'm not going to talk about today that just proves that the virtual, you respond to virtual stuff like real stuff. I don't want to talk about that today, but this is basically how VR works. But again, I care about avatars. How do we build avatars? So if you're subject to my experiment, what happens is you walk in, you sign a form, we take a couple photographs of you, and you sit down and fill out some forms. While you're filling out those forms, I've got three undergraduate brilliant students in the other room, and they're feverishly doing this, which is building what we call a 3D head of you using photogrammetric software. From those two-dimensional photographs, we can stitch together the structure of your face, we can texture it with your actual photographs, and we build this 3D model of you. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes, and when the subjects are done filling out the forms, what we get then is a virtual head that captures 96% of their facial variants. It's an incredible likeness to them. They're real enough that we use them with the Federal Judicial Center for these police lineups. It's a neat way to build your head. It's not hard to do, and it looks a lot like you. It's a quick way to build your avatar. This is my colleague Jack Loomis. I don't know if anyone knows Jack Loomis. He's a vision scientist, and I won't show a video of his head, but you get the general idea. We do know it's not important necessarily to make it look like you. What's more important than making an avatar look like you is it's got to behave like you. It's got to gesture like you. It's got to move with you. You've got to have some way to control it. So what we also take great pains to do in the lab is when we build these things, also make it gesture like you. So here is some software. There's a $30 webcam. This software is actually 7 or 8 years old, or 5 or 6 years old. They haven't... there's been no better update to this technique in the last 5 or 6 years. So we use computer vision. These are not markers on the guy's face. The guy's got nothing on his face. And what we do is use computer vision algorithms to track about 20 points on his face and then animate an avatar to move with him as he moves. This is what it looks like. So he's moving his head around through the webcam. This is a real-time video of him moving his face. This is the 3D model that we are animating in real time as he moves his face. So based on those 22 points, you can deform the mesh. And I'm going to be very honest with you guys, given the theme of this talk series, it doesn't look this good. This is the video that came with the software. It looks about two-thirds this good, okay? And I used to say it looks about one-third this good. It's getting much better. But it's stunning when you see your own face animated like that. It's a very powerful experience. So that's all I want to talk about with technology. But there's one last point I need to make, which is critical to everything else I'm going to talk about. So when I'm doing this webcam and there's people in the audience remotely who are watching me, every time I move or speak, that exact image is captured and is sent over the network. Every bit of information that corresponds to how I'm moving is sent raw and unfiltered. They just get what I'm doing. Virtual reality, when you've got three people interacting inside of VR, what happens is everyone has a virtual scene like this one, which is a conference room. Everyone has the digital information and the models stored locally on their machines. Everyone moves in their own location and their information is tracked. So if one person moves his head, then the computer automatically sends the fact that he's moved his head to the other two people, and the other two people redraw their avatars locally. The other guy's avatar is locally based on the tracking information. So if Judith and I were in a collaborative virtual environment, I would move, my computer would email her computer to say that I've moved. On her computer, she would redraw my avatar 1 meter closer. And this cycle of constantly emailing each other the movements and everybody redrawing each other's movements locally is how Second Life works. It's how a virtual world works. So the critical difference here is in a video conference, what I do, you see. In an immersive virtual environment, I send you tracking data, and you redraw my actions based on what I tell you. Is that difference clear?
Yes.
If that's at all ambiguous, stop me, because it's pretty critical. Okay. And why is this important? This is important because of the idea of transformed social interaction. In the physical world, I do something, you see it. In the digital world, I do something, and it's up to me whether or not I send you behavioral or appearance information that corresponds to what I actually did, or if I send you some filtered, optimized, strategically transformed version of what I did. So I can send you my actual actions, my actual appearance, or I can put an automatic filter on it that sends you things that a strategically perfect version of me, or a strategically unperfect version of me. Whatever I want to send you, I can. And this idea of people interacting with versions of each other that may not correspond to the actual actions are what we're going to talk about for the next 25 minutes. Questions so far? Yeah.
Is there a possibility that these things drift out of sync so that, you know, when you're telling the differences between that, they don't get really applied to what you want?
So that is a great question that leads me into this first study. So basically this idea of synchrony, we break it. So there's this notion in psychology, and communication, it's something we've held dear for a long time. Communication is fragile. Nonverbal and verbal stuff interact in a really timed manner. And if you break this, the world goes awry. And let me tell you about our first study that looks at gaze. So other than me poking you, looking at you in the eye is the most powerful nonverbal tool I have. If I look at you in the eye, your heart beats faster. You're more likely to speak back at me. You like me better. You're more likely to learn something. It's a really powerful tool. In the physical world, though, I've got a limitation. I can look at anyone in this room in the eye, but I can only look at one of you at a time. All right? So this is a big problem. If I think about what I could do if I could look at all of you at the time, and this is whenever we run a study, what we do is we come up with an idea. We do really bad, mediocre artificial intelligence programming, and then we run an experiment to see what happens. So what we did here is we took a simple situation where you had three people come in a room. One guy's job was to teach the other two, or to persuade the other two, and everyone was wearing a helmet with their motions tracked. This guy, unbeknownst to him, we took his head movements and made it so that we factored them down by a factor of 20. So instead of doing this, I just have a little movement to make me natural. And then what we do is, remember, not only can I send optimized versions of myself to you, I can send differently optimized versions to each of you simultaneously. So basically in this study, this guy received this guy's eye gaze for 100% of the time. And so did this guy. So for the entire discourse that went on for that half an hour, each person received the speaker's gaze directly for 100% of the time. Okay, so just that would be for me saying, "Hello, Judith, how are you doing today? I'm glad that you invited me to this talk, Judith," right? No matter what I say verbally, we just tie the nonverbal behavior to each person. So what happens? Four things emerge. The first thing that happens, you can well imagine, is people really don't enjoy this. It's extremely unpleasant. Typically, in a normal conversation, we don't look at each other for more than 6 or 7 seconds. These people each got stared at for 30 minutes straight. So nobody likes it. The second thing is important, that not a single person in the 700 people we've now run in this two at a time or across 3 or 4 studies, not a single person has ever detected that it's not real gaze. So afterwards, we go through great pains to have them describe the interaction. We take lots of pains to get this right. No one ever has any idea that they're not getting the real gaze of the experimenter. They just think they're getting stared at. The third thing that happens is you get nonverbal responses. So in a situation where I'm giving you this super gaze compared to my own actual gaze, you are much more likely just to look at me. So as a social influencer, whether that be a teacher, a salesperson, a politician, getting attention is half the battle. And when I put this super gaze algorithm on, you guys are more likely to return my gaze. How do we know this? The great thing about virtual reality is because in order to render the other guy's behavior, you've got to track it. We can dump all that to a file, and 100 times a second, we know where you're looking. We know how you're leaning. We get great, great nonverbal reservoirs. So, and what's the fourth thing that we get? Persuasion. If I'm trying to sell you something, the odds of you doing this, buying it, increase if I use this algorithm. So the first study we did, there's a very unpopular policy that's proposed, which if you are caught on Stanford's campus without your Stanford ID, you face stiff penalties. Very, very unpopular proposal, but the odds of that Stanford student in this experiment signing it before she leaves increases when you give the super gaze during the presentation. So very powerful, but remember, this is a really dumb algorithm. We used 4 lines of code to shrink the head gaze and stick it on both people at once. Yeah?
So even though they feel much, much they still feel much, much more persuaded?
It's bad medicine. Mm. It's bad medicine. Yeah, you don't always enjoy having, and there's a lot of, so to understand the meeting variables, we're not positive what it is, although we've tested for a lot. We believe it's attention. It's just pure better encoding of the information because you're actually, you know, you're looking at the guy, you're paying attention. But it's, you know, the same way students would rather be multitasking and doing iChat while they're in lecture as opposed to just listening to the lecture. Similar idea. So let's move on to the next study, which is what we call digital chameleons. One of the overriding themes of 60 years of social psychology is that people love themselves. They like people who look like themselves and behave like themselves. We've known this for a long time as a species. As a scientist, probably the most famous person to discover this, a woman named Tanya Chartrand, who was at NYU at the time in the late 90s, had people go into an interview and just non-verbally mimic the interviewer or not. So the interviewer would lean forward, the interviewee would do the same. The interviewer would cross her legs, the interviewee would do the exact same thing. So the experimenters went into this interview mimicking the person interviewing him or her, or doing a variety of types of other types of nonverbal gestures. And what she showed is the odds of you getting a favorable valuation by the interviewer increases drastically when you mimic her nonverbally, even though this is never consciously detected. So since then, been about 30 or 40 studies, one of my favorite by a guy named Rick Van Baron in the Netherlands. If you're a waiter or waitress, and upon receiving an order, instead of saying, "Thank you, sir," you say "ham and eggs," which is repeat the exact thing, last thing that the person said, your tips go up by about 20%. So strong, strong data. Well, what do we know about VR? VR works because everyone's sending each other their tracking data and drawing each other locally on their machine. So it's trivial for me to take your tracking data, which you're sending me so I can draw you, grab it, not even process it, but turn it right around, put my name on it, and send it back to you. In other words, because I have access to everything you're doing, I can co-opt your data and make it a part of my behavior. So I want you to watch this video. This is Nick Yee, one of the most fantastic people I've ever worked with, who's responsible for a lot of this work. And just watch his head movements and watch her movements. So she's trying to convince him of a policy similar to what we talked about earlier. And so he moves his head up. 1, 2, 3, 4, she moves her head up. And again, like I said, we get very uncreative on the AI side, and all we're doing is making her movements are a 4-second slow mirror of his. We tediously ran what's called a psychophysics experiment, where a very boring study you have to run as a pretest to this, which is vary the time lag and the extent of it and find this magic spot between detecting it and between it actually still being interactive. And after a lot of studies, the 4-second window was the perfect one. And so to be brief about the results here, of the 90 subjects we ran in this experiment, only 5 of them consciously detected their own movements, even though they were an exact mirror that went 4 seconds later. So you can imagine we could have gotten clever. We could have made the mimicry probabilistic. We could have scaled it up or down. We could have swapped an axis. There are all sorts of things we can do. We just went dumb and said we're going to delay it 4 seconds. Only 5 of 90 detected this. And then what you get the same effect. So when you're mimicking as opposed to other types of gestures, the subject is more likely to look at the person, they like the person more, and they're more likely to sign off on this unpopular policy. And we've run a few studies on this replicating. We've also replicated the basic concept with touch, virtual touch. So this is right here is a force feedback joystick that basically on one end it records how you move, on the other end it's got 2 motors that play it back. It's a 10-year-old device that we turned on its side, stuck a glove on it, and boom, we've got a handshake machine. And what we did is we had 2 subjects come in, and they shook hands virtually. They never touched each other physically. And one of the subjects, unbeknownst to him, instead of sending his actual handshake data back, grabbed the other guy's handshake and sent it back to him. So basically, one person was shaking his own hand without knowing it. Okay, and what we then did is we had them negotiate, and a classic negotiation task where one person wins money and one person loses money. And when I mimic you, even though I don't know I'm mimicking you, I beat you soundly in the negotiation because you're being nice to me because you like me. So actually showing financial differences based on the simple mimicry algorithm in terms of your virtual touch. It's not just about your actions, it's about your face. I'm going to show you a video now, and I want you to be extremely impressed. And the reason I want you to be impressed with this video is because it was made 6 years ago with software we bought for $19.95 by an 18-year-old communication major who took about 15 minutes to train on it. Okay, so not hard to do, not expensive to buy. This was timely 7 years ago. I'll show it to you again. Simple morphing software that blends pixels, the color value of pixels based on where you draw correspondences with them. So seamlessly, I can blend one face to another, and this is really not hard to do. So we wanted to ask the question, what happens in a real-time conversation when one person simply makes his or her face look more like someone else's? Why do we do this? If I look like you, you find me more attractive, more persuasive, you're more likely to buy something from me. If I'm laying on the street clutching my knee in agony, the odds of you stopping to help me increase if I share physical characteristics with you. And a recent study by Lisa De Bruyn. Yeah?
Not everybody probably knows who the second face
was. Oh. I live in California. We take this as that's Arnold.
And the second one is Jim McGreevy.
No, it is Gray Davis, who we booted from his post in a special recall vote. Also, the Lisa De Bruyn study show that if a babysitter looks more like you, you're more likely to let her spend time alone with your kids. So we use physical similarity as a really important clue when figuring out if we can trust someone, if we like them. So we ran an experiment. We paid a lot of money to get a national random sample, as opposed to the college kids we typically use, all ages, sizes, socioeconomic status. 6 months before the 2004 presidential election, we passively acquired photographs of them that we put in a database. Over the next 6 months, we had undergraduates morphing pictures between voters and candidates. And we had three groups of subjects. In one group, we just presented Bush and Kerry side by side. In one group, we had the voter morphed with George Bush and someone else of the same gender morphed with John Kerry for control. And in a third group, we had the self morphed with John Kerry and someone else morphed with Bush. So it was either the normal pictures, or we made Bush look more like the voter, or Kerry look more like the voter. Let me give you a sense what this looks like. So this is a six-year-old photo of me. That is George Bush, and this is the 60-40 blend. We've now run over 1,200 subjects on this in four different elections over the last 7 years. If you stay below 40%, no one ever consciously detects this. And 1,200 people, the last part of the experiment, we have them in detail describe this picture of the candidate in a paragraph they have to write about it. Not a single person has had any idea that we have captured their face and put it in there. So if you go over 40%, it's blatantly obvious, but sticking around below 40, it works well. Yes?
Subject and John Kerry have substantially different skin color. What'd you do with that?
You know what we do? We just morph it. We don't pretend to be artists. We just use a mathematical algorithm, blends it at 60-40, and no one detects it. Okay. And we can talk about the differences in data, what happens if it's different races, et cetera, but no one ever detects it. And your point is well taken. It's a big difference between me, who sadly looks like George Bush and produces Alfred E. Newman when we're morphed.
The face and not the skin color.
We are doing a really uninteresting algorithm that takes a pixel, lines it up with the pixel, and averages the RGB values.
Okay.
There's not even anything structural going on. It's really, really simple.
Is there any specific facial differences why in both cases the Bush looks so much more like himself than Kerry?
In this picture?
On both cases. No, on this case. Yes.
Oh, in this case?
Yeah.
One fascinating thing that came out, so a lot of stuff that I do that I'm going to talk about, I can't publish because it's fascinating but not theoretically interesting. George Bush, so we morphed George Bush with a sample of hundreds and hundreds of national random sample, and you can look at the algorithms to see how hard it had to work. George Bush has the most average face of any human we've ever done this to, in the sense that he's similar to, regardless of gender, I'm not talking about just with white men, George Bush is really average looking, and that helps, obviously.
Interesting.
I tried. So let me tell you about the study.
Maybe if you ran all the presidential elections,
exactly.
Statistically, if the most average looking people tend to win.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's great work by a guy at Princeton, Todorov, Alexander, who has done just what you said, Judith, with not averageness, but ratings of how competent one looks. and looking competent can predict winners of 78% of elections over the last 50 years or something ridiculous. But okay, but to your point, so let me go on to what we found. So this is a week, so a week before the election, we presented them with pictures of Bush and Kerry side by side. This is a very charged election. People care about this very deeply, and we go a week before the election and just ask them who they're going to vote for. What we find is in the control condition, we had a great sample. It was Bush 46, Kerry 44, so we know we had a good sample. When the self was morphed with Bush, Bush wins by 14 points. When the self was morphed with Kerry, Kerry wins by 7. And again, no one has consciously detected this. This is all an implicit affinity that one gets towards a candidate just because he looks more like him. So we were excited about this. And now to your point, so we wrote this up and we sent it to the best political science journal. This was my colleague Shanto Iyengar, who is a very of high repute political scientist. And we were, you know, this is stunning stuff. And we sent it to them and they laughed. I don't even think they sent it out for review. And the problem with political science is founded upon the notion that the voter is rational. If you look at all the poli-sci studies, there's 1,000 of them in the last 100 years. There's about 15 or 20 that do with anything nonverbal. And as political scientists, we really like to think that rational choice is paramount. So what do? We went back to the drawing board. We've now replicated this 3 times. We did it with 2008 candidates. We did it with an obscure election, Florida's governor's election, obscure to our the people in the national sample, where we flopped at 20 points. This is the strongest effect I've ever found in anything scientific. You can't make it go away. So finally, we finally got this published after having to replicate it 4 or 5 times and put it all in one paper. But there's a lot of resistance and a lot of people. One of the criticisms was, well, there's no theory there. And of course there was. But let me move on. And I want to move on now to a line of studies that I'm going to loosely throw under the rubric of ethics. And a line of studies that became Nick Yee's dissertation that we began in the year 2003 asked the big question, if I wear an avatar that may be different from me in some way, whether it's race or it's gender or its physical characteristics, do I come to take the characteristics of that avatar? Meaning, if it looks different for me, do I psychologically become more like my avatar? So we did that in 2003. Does that sound familiar to anybody? What does that sound like? This movie that James Cameron just made. How many of you guys have seen the movie Avatar? This is in the trailer. Basically, the main idea of the movie is that somebody takes on a new species as an avatar and gains empathy for the species, becomes like it, and we're very angry at James Cameron for taking our idea and not paying us for it, but that's okay. I'm just kidding. All right, so let me show you this movie here. This is Nick walking around, and he's wearing the head-mounted display. His behaviors are tracked, and the paradigm for all this work is what happens when you go up to a virtual mirror. We use the mirror as a way of showing identity. So Nick goes in front of the mirror. He moves his head around. He gestures. It takes about 90 seconds to get the correspondence. So 90 seconds of gesturing with your avatar. You can see there that he's a white man. He goes down. We hit a button. Boom. He comes up, and he's now a woman of color. Okay. And the big question we ask is when you're forced to wear an avatar that has a social characteristic that's different from your own, do you behave like your physical self, or do you come to behave like your virtual self? And that's the question that we're going to ask in the following line of studies. The way that we did this is, here's a bird's eye view of what the room looks like. The S stands for subject. This is the mirror. The C stands for something called a confederate. A confederate in an experiment is a person that is he's part of the study. He exhibits behaviors according to a specific script, and basically it's a way of facilitating the study. So the question we wanted to ask is, when the subject sees himself having a certain characteristic, when he's interacting with a confederate, does he change his behavior to fall in line with his virtual characteristic? So both these guys are in VR. I'm going to point out an important detail. There's 2 ways that me having an avatar can change my behavior. One is you see me as 5 feet taller. You treat me differently based on that, and then I behave differently because of your treatment. Okay, that's called behavior confirmation. We didn't want to look at that. We wanted to isolate somebody's behavior just based solely on the belief that they have a certain characteristic. So let's pretend that we were manipulating height. When the subject thought he was 5 feet taller, the Confederate always saw him as actual height. So even though he thought he was 5 feet taller, the Confederate never knew was experimentally blind to the manipulation. So everything that we capture in this line of studies had to do with the belief that the subject has a certain characteristic. And let me just give you a quick view of what this will look like. So this is the subject, you'll see some of the examples of things we manipulate. What you see there is a very attractive avatar. We've pre-tested the face to be very attractive. We can also swap in a face that's less attractive. We've gotten that from a pre-test as well. That's a face that's not as attractive according to undergraduates' ratings. And then he turns around, the subject does, and there's another person in VR with him. And what happens is that we record what happens in that conversation when the person thinks she's got an attractive face versus an unattractive face. So any questions on how that works? The general paradigm?
Can you repeat what the conclusion of that is?
I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, okay.
Haven't gotten there yet. So we've done this with about 5 or 6 different identity cues in about 20 or 30 different studies now. So let's look at attractiveness. When you go to the mirror and you're wearing an attractive face, and then the Confederate asks you to walk up to her and have a conversation, if I've got an attractive face compared to an unattractive face, when she asks me to come over, I will step a meter closer to her than if I've got an unattractive face. Meaning, having that face makes me feel so confident that I'll walk closer. If I've got an attractive face, I will look her in the eye more as I talk to her, compared to an average face or an unattractive face. And what we then do is we tape record the conversations, and we play them back to judges who have no idea what's going on in the experiment. All that they're trying to do is rate how confident someone sounds in their speech patterns. When I've got an attractive face, I divulge more personal information about myself, and I speak more socially than when I've got an unattractive one. And remember, this is based on 90 seconds of exposure in this virtual mirror, and later on, no one has any idea that we're manipulating attractiveness. It's not as if those two faces look, one was, looked like not even human or anything. These are very subtle changes. All this is operating implicitly in the 600 subjects we've run in the attractive study over a number of studies. No one ever has any conscious idea that we've made them attractive or unattractive. Yeah.
Was there any differences between average and unattractive?
In the attractiveness study, most of the studies we've just pitted attractiveness against unattractive. And the one of the three studies where it was averages, it looks pretty much like a linear. If you look at the three, but it's mostly most of the action comes from the other two cells because they're very subtle, the differences.
Do all these morphing come into somebody of the same gender?
Here there's no morphing. It's just they wear one standard attractive face or one standard unattractive face.
A face that's of their own gender.
In this study, yes. I could talk about one.
That would really warp things if I got a very attractive face, but it was a female one.
Yeah, I don't have a slide on this now, but ask me in Q&A. I'll talk about the great studies. I have a woman, Jessie Fox, who works in my lab. She's very interested in the notions of sexuality and how exposure to digital media is warping our views of what it means to have sexual identities. And I'll talk about that when we're done. So that's the attractive study, height. So it turns out in the physical world, height is correlated with income. It's correlated with how gregarious you are in a situation, lots and lots of things. We've known this for 50 or 60 years. In the online world, a very depressing study came out of MIT, actually. And I think Wharton was the other school. Anyway, they got all the back-end data from online dating studies, and they looked at the percentage of time that somebody would go out with someone based on their features. Based on a man, for every inch below 5'10 you are, to get the same number of dates or clicks as the guy who's 1 inch taller than you, you've got to make an extra $30,000. So you can actually compute the function of height, as it turns out, with dating. So we wanted to look at this in terms of, well, what happens if you manipulate height? And we brought people in into virtual world, and we had them look at each other right there, and we simply made the subject 10 centimeters taller, equal to, or 10 centimeters shorter than the Confederate. So 10 centimeters, about that big. Really subtle differences. No one had any idea consciously that height was a big factor. We then did what's called the ultimatum game, which is a classic money-splitting task. When you are 10 centimeters shorter
compared to the other two conditions, taller or equal, you are three times as likely to lose that negotiation. Three times as likely to accept a losing bargain than when you're their other height. So being made shorter in an interaction has profound implications on how you perform in a negotiation. It also affects people's confidence in virtual worlds, and all this happens independent of their physical height. So by manipulating, making someone 10 centimeters taller, they behave more confidently regardless of how tall they are physically. I'm going to talk about the age study in a moment, so I want to talk about it here.
In the age study, the Confederates still saw them as the average height?
The Confederate, we used 7th grade trigonometry, which it's always fun when you get to reuse something you haven't thought about. We used the Pythagorean theorem and cosine function. So the Confederate always saw him as equal height. And then the problem is what happens when you look up or down given that, and that's when you use the silly math. So Confederate always saw...
Obviously, the subject saw them looking up or down, but the Confederate didn't know that they were taller or shorter.
The subject perceived himself as taller.
Right.
The Confederate perceived himself as equal.
Right.
So we're isolating the pure belief. So I want to move on to transfer here, because I do want to get to some other things, and I want to leave a good time for Q&A. The most fascinating part is that this stuff extends face-to-face. So in the attractiveness study, if I put you in an attractive avatar for 20 minutes and you have this interaction compared to an unattractive avatar, I then take you out of VR, take your helmet off, pay you, walk you down 4 flights of stairs, and on the way out, some graduate student comes running from the other room and says, I need subjects for my dissertation. If you'll fill out this form for 3 minutes, I'll give you $10. So they think it's completely unrelated. Everyone bought that it wasn't our study. And what they then did is they filled out, the bogus study was ostensibly about online dating, and they filled out an online dating profile, part of which was choosing people that you thought with whom you had a shot. So picking people of the opposite gender or same gender, if that was your preference, that you think you had a chance that they'd go out with you. And half an hour later, when you had an attractive face in VR, you pick better looking people when you're down in this task, because the confidence that you've gained in this virtual world spills over to the physical world. With the height study, if I put you in this simulation where you're 10 centimeters taller, you spend 20 minutes together, I then take you out of the simulation, take great pains so that you never see each other physically, sit you in special chairs that guarantees that you're the exact same height, and then you have the negotiation, the data is identical. So the hierarchy that formed subtly in the virtual space due to the height differential carries over to your subsequent face-to-face task. Yeah?
Have there been any studies on people, you know, with avatars that are not human?
Agents, do you mean? Or?
Well, no, I mean other forms, animals.
I mean they just look non-human.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to talk about, there's a lot of research done varying how anthropomorphic they are and how seriously one takes it in a social situation, but not as it relates to these questions, and I'd be happy to talk with you about that in the Q&A. Okay, I want to switch to a different type of ethical question, and we call this déjà vu. It feels like I've never been here before. Shorter name, I'm settling on this, calling them doppelgangers. But this asks the big question, if I build a version of you, that version of Jack Loomis I showed you looked just like him. I've got forever the structure of his face. I've got forever the way that he moves his face, his idiosyncrasies, and I store that in a digital file. The same way that you have an MP3, a digital song, I can then make a million copies of it. It'll be around forever. It's never going away. But more critical to me than those two factors are, once I've got that avatar built, I can put preset animations on it, and it can do anything that I can fathom. So once your model's built, unlike a video, I can't tweak a video to make you say something you never said or do something you've never done. With the model itself, once I've built it, it is my puppet forever. And we ask the big question, this is the work I'm excited about now, both in good and bad ways, what happens when one witnesses her virtual self performing some behavior she's never physically done? So what happens when I see myself virtually doing something that I've never done physically? And really getting excited about the possibilities, but again, both good and bad about this. The first line of studies deals with health behavior modeling. So my student Jesse Fox is very excited about using VR to make people healthy, and she's run a number of studies now. This is her dissertation, where I can tell you you're supposed to exercise, and I can give you abstract stats that if you exercise, you're going to lose weight and be healthier and live longer. But if I put you in the lab and I have you, here's a subject on the left, he runs in place, and that's his avatar. You can't see the face, looks just like him. As he's running in place, every six times his knee raises his chest, he loses about 1.5% of his width. So after 20 minutes of running, he actually sees very viscerally the cause and effect of his exercise on his weight. So we can show you yourself losing weight based on moving. We can then make you stand still for 20 minutes and make you gain weight. We can. So what happens when you do this? So getting someone to exercise is one of the hardest things any social scientist can do, because people know they're supposed to. You can tell them to do it, but they don't want to. So the first study she ran, she did a simulation like this and then sent them home and asked them 24 hours later to say, to give a diary of all the work they'd done exercising. And in that first study, people exercised over 30 minutes more in a 24-hour period when they saw a simulation like this compared to other control conditions. Now, as a lab, we tend to not trust self-report stuff, so we didn't really believe that, though we were excited it was in the right direction. For the next four studies we ran, we put them in the lab, gave them something like this, and then ended the study and said, you know what, we got 20 minutes before the next round of subject comes in. If you want to, here's a treadmill. You can work out for 15 minutes if you want. And when you show the self losing weight as a function of exercise, people will stay for 10 times longer than in other types of control conditions. For example, when it's someone else's face that's losing the weight, or when there's no weight loss in the virtual simulation. Yeah.
Were they consciously aware that
this one is all kind? It's blatant. This falls in the category of we're hitting them over the head with it, but the experience is so visceral. So you ran another study where it wasn't about exercise, it was about eating. And this was a first-person point of view where you look down and you see your torso. And basically, we take control of the subject's arm, and he or she repeatedly eats for 25 minutes Reese's Pieces, and we watch the gut grow, and we watch the thighs grow. In addition to changing actual eating behavior when they left the lab, we then give them a really boring task that has candy sitting next to them and watch how much they eat. So, A, we change that. That's our quantitative data. But just the qualitative data, people take that helmet off and they feel sick. They feel full. They salivate more. One of the studies in Jess's dissertation is she puts cotton swabs in there, and she's measuring the weight of them in terms of how much you actually salivate based on them. So this falls in the category of we hit you over the head with it because everyone knows you're supposed to exercise, right? And this is just doing anything to make them feel the motivation to do so. Yeah.
To audio instead of visual? Like
we've compared it to text. A nice passage that you read about the benefits of exercise. So there's a classic, the classic control condition, lots of the psychology work on this is it's called mental imagery. So we've had them sit down and imagine what it would be like if you exercised and saw yourself losing the weight. And compared to that, we show big gains with virtual reality.
No, but the audio.
We've never done just audio. We've never done just, but we can. We can talk about that. The next study I want to talk about is false memories. And for this one, my student, Catherine Segovia, is a very brave human being. In addition to these virtual reality studies, which are brutally difficult to run because the equipment is very buggy, she brought in 70 preschoolers and elementary school kids, brought them in three separate times to the lab. The first time, they put on the helmet and they saw themselves, their own head, swimming around with a whale. There's a huge literature on false memory formation. It turns out the gold standard of false memory is if you have a child actively imagine, come on and sit down, Johnny. I want you to imagine what it was like when you swam around with whales. Imagine what it would be like. Think about the colors, how it would smell. If the child actively participates, that causes false memories to occur at a very high rate. What we wanted to do is bring them in and say, well, what happens if this process is no longer active? It's passive in the sense that instead of telling them to imagine it, they put the helmet on and we show them themselves swimming around with whales. She brought them back a week later. 50% of the elementary school kids who came back a week later sat down and would tell you what it was like at SeaWorld when they went there physically, had confabulated details about what it was. 50% of our children form false memories. Now, to be fair, we did run the control condition of imagine, and in the imagine condition, it was also around 50%. But the critical factor there is it's no longer passive. The child no longer has to be an active participant in the process. Just by showing her media, she can have this form. We ran other control conditions that the memory rate was close to zero. So very strong effect. This one takes the classic, Paul, you'll be interested in this, the classic study that we talk about in science fiction, and everyone's talked about for a long time, but stunningly no one's ever run the study, which is, you know, remember the Tom Cruise, you're walking down the sidewalk in the movie, somebody catches your picture, and then by the time you hit the other corner, you're on a billboard, not only using a product, but loving it. We decided to run this simple study. The first study we ran was actually just using 2D media. We simply photoshopped somebody into a billboard using a fictional project, a beverage, in this case, Casina. Sometime later, we brought them in and gave them a barrage of brands and just tested their recall and their preference. And what we showed is that when the self is using the brand, you remember it better and you like it better later on. We've run a number of follow-ups that not just show you using it, but show you using it and having positive consequences as a result. So you're wearing a certain shirt brand, and somebody walks up to you, looks at your shirt brand, and then sits down next to you as opposed to another person. And showing big gains in product preference based on the fact that you can embed interactivity and embed consequences into these simulations. So it takes this idea of marketing to no longer, we're not passive absorbers, we're active participants, whether we want to or not. I've been working with people in the Center for Longevity at Stanford on trying to improve one's connection with the future self. So kids today can't even fathom, 18-year-olds kids, college students can't even fathom what it's going to be like when they're 30, let alone when they're 60. As a consequence, they're not saving any money. It's going to cause all sorts of problems for them later. So this study is part of a larger project to get young people to save money. And what we did is we basically used age-morphing software to show them what they would look like when they were 70 years old, and then put them in the virtual mirror and showed them, basically made them control their future self and showed them consequences of what would happen if one had money or not. And then gave them, when they left the lab, we gave them a gratification task, a delay of gratification task. Take some money now or take more money later. And what we show is that students are much more likely to save money when you give them this connection with their future self than when not. Okay, last study I'm going to talk about. I realize I've been talking quickly at you for a long time. This is something I've never talked about publicly, so I'd love to hear what you think about this. So there's a new branch of the military/government called IARPA. It stems out of DARPA. And they made a very large call, large in terms of money, for grants that could, scientists that could detect someone's gender. So the grant was all about, they wanted just to see if this was possible with any social characteristic. Can you detect someone's gender over 75% rate based on what's called their digital footprint? When they made this call, we'd spent a lot of time talking to them for various reasons. And the study I'm going to tell you about, the call, the IARPA call, the Reynards proposal it's called, was based on the study I'm going to tell you now. The problem with use, so what is a digital footprint? It's all the massive amounts of tracking data that you leave behind. So when you're surfing the web, people can detect with cookies where you're moving your mouse, where you are, what you're typing, and what websites you visit. When you're walking in VR, 100 times a second, I know where you've looked, I know what you've said, I know how you've moved your arm, I know your emotions, I know your posture, I know who you've stood near. Because in order to render virtual world, I have to track everything at a very high rate, that can get dumped to a file, and you've got the most detailed behavioral account of someone's actions than we've ever had before in history. The problem from a social science standpoint, there's all sorts of ethical problems that we can talk about, and I welcome it. From a social science standpoint, what we've never had before, you've got people that have got all the tracking data, meaning scientists that have somehow got all the World of Warcraft data. Or you can look at the players, but no one's ever been able to get the players and tie them to the tracking data. Meaning, if you want to be able to detect someone and train models, you've got to know ground truth. You've got to be able to tie the footprint to people so that you can know who they are. So we ran a study at Stanford. It was actually a class. I had 80 Stanford students go in the online world called Second Life. They spent 10 hours a week for 6 weeks, and every second, I dumped about 50 variables to a file based on what they were doing, ranging from if they were, what their animations were, where they were in the world, what they were saying, where they were standing, if they were running or walking, if they were flying, everything you possibly could dump, I dumped into a file. Now, these are 80 students in my class, so I knew who they were. They got on scales and I measured their weight. They got against the wall, we measured their height. They filled out every personality questionnaire that we trusted. We had their GPAs, we knew their race, we knew their gender. I knew who these people were. So we had ground truth, and then we had hard drives of data about each one of them. And so what we could then do, I'm going to put a picture of a Second Life just because I... This is a funny story here, a side story. So in order to do this, the students had to wear this little invisible device called a sender when they, in order to record the data. And this is the TA of the... It was a class. This is the TA of the class. And these are the students lining up to get the sender. I just find it hilarious that in a virtual world, they still line up. And they line up just using one axis when they could be everywhere. It's really funny. So what do we have? We've got all this information about who these people are, and then we've got all this data that we can use to form correlations. So we used a kind of mathematical formula called a learning algorithm. Examples of those are neural networks, support vector machines. Basically, the way this works is I have 80 Stanford students. So let's take the example of gender. Those 80 students, I take 40 of them to train my model. I leave 40 of them over there. For those 40 students, what I do is I take all this data and I run these algorithms that slowly can figure out patterns correlating the output, which is the gender, male or female, with all the data on the input. And then I can feed it subjects one at a time, and over many iterations, it slowly learns these patterns. So by going what's called bottom up, a really atheoretical brute force approach, by using these correlations, over time, with these 40 subjects, I come up with these magic formulas that can say, given a behavioral footprint, this guy's male or female. Then I can take these other 40 that it's never seen, and I can feed it into those algorithms, and I can see how often it gets them right. And therefore, based on just getting the tracking data from this new 40, it can figure out how accurate the algorithms are. Does that make sense? Yeah, was that blatantly obvious for all you guys? I guess I'm at Harvard. I don't need to do that. All right, so what we found here was just stunning. Let me just show you the data. So kappa is, it's kind of like a correlation. It varies from -1 to 1. Of every factor we looked at, let me list them for you because it's a small font. This is demographics. Whether you're African-American, whether you're Asian, whether you're Caucasian, your height, your major, whether you had a BA or BS, your sex, how much physical activity you did, your weight, personality, how sexist you were, the big five is the most respected personality metrics, these are the five dimensions of it, and your self-esteem. Every cap was over 0.20, which means stands for a low predictive success. Most of them are over 0.4, which is moderate to high, and this is the percentage points above chance. Again, don't worry about the details. The bottom line is this digital footprint predicts not only who you are in terms of demographics, but very subtle aspects of your personality. So basically the way you move around in Second Life and whether you choose to fly or walk, and if you choose to stand within 8 feet of someone or 2 feet, can tell me just about everything about you. This is goes back to this theoretical idea. So there's no new computer science here. It's a boring computer science section. I'm using off-the-shelf CS stuff. And from the personality standpoint, this is atheoretical. So when you look at those magic formulas, what makes me predict whether or not you're male or female? Whether it's a polynomial formula that takes into account all these ridiculous factors that when you look at it, it makes no sense. So it's been challenging. Actually, I mean, we've been shooting high. We go for science and nature and then psych science, but still trying to find this falls under the category of very fascinating. And if I was trying to sell it, which I'm not, then there'd be a market. But from the academic standpoint, it's been complicated. But it's under review at a new place now, and I'm optimistic. So let me close there and say the digital world is wonderful and scary. If you're a social scientist who's studying this stuff, it's fantastic. As a citizen, it's a bit scary. Transforming the self is effective and also hard to detect, which is what makes it so effective. I would posit that this is not just... You know, this is not just new resolution or a better gadget. The idea that we can be an avatar that in which we can disengage behavior and appearance is a qualitatively new way to think about how we exist and how we identify. Last, I'd like to say this work is extremely labor-intensive. I'd speak as if I did it all, but especially as I get older in my career, I do less and less of it, and lots of great people helping me there. So, thank you so much, and I really want to hear questions. Yeah.
It's really interesting. My question is about, so I heard recently that the U.S. State Department has purchased land in Second Life, and I've also seen some talks that they've had with, like, Egyptian bloggers in Second Life. So my question is about the implications of this research for the future of diplomacy and how we connect between governments and government to people.
Let me tell you about a non-classified project I'm doing with the U.S. Army, which is soldiers get sent to Iraq and have to talk to the Iraqi citizens and have just no idea how to connect with them. So one thing that we're doing is coming up with portable simulations to put them in the shoes of an Iraqi citizen, that just to get them more accustomed to what it's like to be that person with the nonverbal norms, using VR. There's a lot of people who are, there's a really big idea that is brutally difficult to implement when it's fun to talk about but hard to build, which is this cultural translator, which is if I make this gesture which is inappropriate in one culture, my avatar automatically does the right thing. It's a very fun idea, but it's really hard to do that. But I like that idea in answer to your question of coming to these common grounds and preventing gaffes and making people better tied. In terms of diplomacy, just making my avatar, again, ethics issues aside, from if you wanted to say, what's the best chance of me getting that person to sign that treaty? I'm going to make my face more like hers. I'm going to make, I'm going to make all the things we talked about, the mimicry. I'm going to use whatever tool I have in order to make it happen. Ethics aside.
Yeah. I have a question about the last bit of stuff, the Second Life predictor thing you were running. Uh-huh. The thing that was interesting to me was, if I was interpreting what you were saying correctly, people tend to behave in Second Life in a way that is similar to the way they behave and identify in real life. And the interesting thing, or the reason that interested me, was because I thought that a lot of the reason that Second Life was interesting was because people tended to behave differently and experiment with their identity.
Yeah.
And one of the things I know, I was wondering if you thought that might be because the people who were running in the study were doing it because it was kind of a study, and so they were sort of behaving like, this is how I'm behaving, as opposed to people who are really into identity play. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm a pretty nice person in real life, but I used to, in a former lifetime when I was running around in Second Life, I flung a bunch of digital phalluses at Anche Chung, uh-huh. and that's something that I wouldn't do in real life. So
the answer I have to that one is, I love the question, and the best... If I'm feeling aggressive, the way that I answer that question is, there's this cartoon that we like to put up in talks. It's on the internet. No one knows you're a dog.
Right.
Bottom line is, you can put a mask on that says you're a dog, but given the wealth of behavioral data I have, you can't hide the fact that you're not a dog. Whether or not the students are acting differently because they're in the class, certainly they may have been, but they were totally anonymous, meaning their Second Life name was tied in a really unintelligible way to their physical actual life, and they did some pretty racy things, but they could have been a bit more reserved.
So what your data show is that even if people do, for instance, superficial changes, like instead of hiding their dog, maybe they dress up like a furry in Second Life, whatever they're doing, the behavioral data of the things that they actually do are concord with their internal identity as opposed to whatever they think they're playing.
Yeah, you can put on a mask, but you can't intentionally, or it's very difficult to mask the fact that you tend to stand a meter closer towards men than women, or the way that you move is a little bit jerky, or that when you speak, you tend to type in the passive voice as opposed to the active voice. I mean, it's just real difficult. And so there can be this great arms race that comes off of people masking that stuff too, and it just gets out of control pretty quickly.
Just to follow up to that question, but so doesn't that, maybe I misunderstood that, doesn't that finding, the last one, conflict with the idea that if you change who you are, you feel and act differently? If you change the way your avatar looks?
You know, I like to talk about this stuff, the catch-22 of virtual worlds, which is you can be anything you want, but there's a couple rules that are just bedrocked and don't go away. And that's, social science is always a question of tendencies, not absolute truth. It's not chemistry. So I feel comfortable with two propositions that, if it were clean, would contradict, but social science is gray.
I do a long interview with a virtual cannibal because I want to do a deep dive with one user, and I had to, exactly what Jeremy just described, did his behavior, virtual cannibalism, model than what he did in real life?
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree, but then there was also a way in which who this guy was, he might not have been that nice in real life, but
right.
who he was in the real world, it did translate into how he behaved in the virtual world.
So we see some correlations, but not other correlations, and it's
there's no absolutes in this stuff.
Yeah, right.
It's all so new. I mean, I'm presenting you a series of somewhat independent findings and just trying to make sense of them as I go along.
the modeling behavior and then the false memories for the children, why do you think in modeling physical behavior, visualization is not as effective as in with the false memories, where it's, there's a much higher correlation with the objectification?
It's a great question. The visceral aspect of watching yourself gain weight, the visual aspect of that, is so much more powerful from a perceptual standpoint than the imagined one, and that's not I don't think that's as compelling an answer as you want for it. But when you put that helmet on and see yourself gain weight, as opposed to imagining, it's just.
But imagining swimming with dolphins is almost as compelling as seeing.
I'm going to give you more because
it's
what we're proactive instead of a passive
observer. Well, that's children. Children also have much more vivid mental imagery.
Right. And sort of more hypnotizability, if you will.
Right.
So
yeah,
when kids imagine things, it actually is more real for them typically than when Western adults.
We tried running the false memory study with adults, and it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by sort of the behavior mimicking thing. I keep thinking of this episode of The Office, where and this character Andy comes in and he decides he's going to work his way to the top by totally mirroring behavior,
right.
And then he does it, you know, and so. But I wonder about the applications of that in real life, like in terms of you assign a particular teacher to a particular group of kids, do you benefit from assigning a teacher to a particular group of kids based on any one of a certain set of qualities or similarities, or for that matter for in things like diplomacy,
mm-hmm.
would you choose a diplomat to go meet with another diplomat based on similar characteristics?
Yeah, look, I think that's a great observation, and it's certainly not a new idea. So you've got this, I'm going to call it wonderful, but it's probably horrible, TV show called Welcome Back, Kotter, where they got a sweat hog to teach the sweat hogs, right? I mean, we've known that if you can form a connection with someone, you're more effective. But with VR, the sweat hog can be simultaneously cast to hundreds of people, and, you know, he can be, when the teacher needs to be stoic to one person, he's stoic to that one person. When he needs to be expressive to the person who's expressive, at the same time he's expressive to that person. When he needs to be 70 years old to a project authority towards one person, he can be that age. When he needs to, you know, you can be all those people simultaneously, and that's where the real power comes in, I think.
The person who's studying the micro expressions, I can think like Ekman and his work, right? The person who can figure that out, though, in any situation of persuasion, if it's live, though,
right,
then that person wins.
Well, here's the difference with what's happening now and the stuff that Ekman's been doing for a while. Ekman has had to do the very difficult job of looking at pictures and hand coding, finding these patterns. We now get to do the brute force bottom up. Anytime you're in a virtual world, you get. So this Second Life study, why was I successful in predicting this stuff? The only reason is because I had mountains of data for each person, and over time these models can chug and chug and chug and chug, and when we do these, computers work for about a week to build the model, and then you come back, you just have so much more data.
I was wondering if you've done anything
with Facebook. Specifically, they have this little known and less used feature called the view as function,
mm-hmm.
where you can now go ahead and Dana's done a lot of stuff with this. She proposed the privacy mirror thing like 10 years ago, and basically you can go on and then you can see how you appear to each one of your friends on Facebook, and you can change through the friends list features how you appear. And the view as feature is a really interesting thing when you watch people, how they think they appear to other people. And how they actually appear,
uh-huh.
and the view as feature is a tool that they can use. It's a mirror,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps less elegant or certainly different than what you're doing. I was wondering if you looked at that at all or
no,
studied
same
that.
Same big idea. That's fast. It's same, you know, same big idea. Absolutely. Well, one of my favorite studies on Facebook, there's a guy named Jeff Hancock at Cornell. He brought in, he's in the communication.
He will probably be a speaker later this semester.
Should I not ruin his...
No, go ahead. I'm sure he has many other things to say.
He's one of my favorite scholars. He had online daters come in from places like Facebook, and he captured their profile and brought them in, weighed them, took their heights, looked at their W-2s, and looked at the amount of deception, and I won't ruin his punchline here, so when he comes, you can read his paper, just quantifying when the deception happens, but maybe it would happen less with something like that.
Wondering if your future self had a great experience over an extended period of time, it wouldn't be so scary to get older.
The future self stuff has been getting a lot of traction recently, and it's a real simple idea
that I think a lot of great stuff could happen from it. One study I didn't talk about, Nick Yee did, it turns out college students are very ageist. They've got strong stereotypes against people who are over the age of 65, and they're not positive ones. If you force an 18-year-old to wear an older avatar for about 30 minutes and then give him or her the standard barrage of ageism, you show that those go down. That is, you gain an empathy and understanding, and you're a nicer person about it, at least for the next hour. Yeah,
but I'm wondering about your own feelings.
I mean, this is the whole idea of Stanford's Center on Longevity is not to extend life, but to make it so that you enjoy those later years more. And this study is really geared towards that. But the problem, this study we're doing, this is of all the things I talked about, the aging of the faces is the most labor intensive. It's tough to do. Yeah.
Just a comment. Well, as I was watching sort of the first half of this, all I could think of is there's an enormous amount of law that's going to have to be created to deal with all of those issues that doesn't exist and nobody, you know, it exists on the very margins of advertising, but really has never dealt with anything like this.
Yeah, there's been a couple landmark papers I've read in terms of the using the self. And if you read the law discussion around the Orville Redenbacher case, it's pretty fascinating because there's been a number of discussions about, you know, reusing, say, Fred Astaire.
That kind of law does exist. But I was thinking more about the filtering. I don't want to use false, but the filtering of the data that gets transmitted to someone else.
Yep. You know, so I play devil's advocate on both sides. And sometimes I say, well, look, you know, when you're in a classroom and a student asks a question, that's just the dumbest question you've ever heard. And you want to just say to this person, you want to react in the way that is natural. You don't do that. You put a mask on. You encourage that person. So we are always filtering all the time. It's just the question is it just the volume button, or is it a completely new exponential transformation? You know, and that's going to be, from a legal standpoint, you know, I know nothing about law, but I think that will be the question. Is it the same as the stuff we do face to face? I mean, look, I'm wearing a tie. Why am I wearing a tie? Because maybe it makes me look a little bit more official. And is that filtering? You know, it's
no, it's going to be really interesting.
Sure.
I mean, if I can wear lifts in my shoes, can I make myself 2 inches taller when I project my avatar?
Yeah, and these are the questions. I mean, I don't know what the standard is, and you know, it's a jungle out there right now. I mean, watching the arms race of figuring this stuff out, defending against it, you know, it's gonna be. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, when Jeff Hancock talks about it, I like to talk about Jeff's data on dating, which is, you know, online daters lie. Everybody lies. Everybody lies. You know, males lie about their height and their income. Women lie more often about their weight and age. That's everybody lies. And what's allowable? Jeff's answer is you lie just enough so that you can consummate the relationship. That's
what the market will bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it does come to the question of what do you consider evidence. Mm. So it's really, really easy for me to write a text to you that says, I'm 6'3". And we all know that it's just as easy to write, I'm 6'3", I'm 4'11". You know, the effort to write those or the truth, you know, somewhere around 5'4". It's effort-wise, it's the same thing. But we trust it as evidence because of other reasons why I have to act in an honest way. Mm-hmm. But right now, we assume that things that we've seen in front of us, we don't need to have those additional levels of why they should be trustworthy as evidence, because the seeing it itself is the marker of truth. And so what we're seeing here is the removal of the fact that you have seen it from being outside that fictionalization. But we still deal in a world of text. We just have other ways of deciding whether we're going to believe what we've read, because simply the existence of a phrase in text is not sufficient. And so part of it is, I think, a big question around what is going to happen to our, how do we train our perception to be less trusting?
Less what?
Less trusting.
Well, there was a problem when the first cell phones came out, was that people were used to phones being secure. But anybody with a radio scanner could listen in on cell phones until they went digital. But people had this view that what they were saying was secure. And here we have this concept that, well, I may be seeing it through an avatar, but it's going to be real. And I think until people get trained that it isn't, they're going to use the same tricks they do now, which is if I see it, I can make a judgment about it.
In Second Life.
Media literacy.
Yeah.
People have developed literacy for interaction in a virtual world.
They're developing it, but it's going, you know, in Second Life, the ratio of female users to female avatars is very low. Okay, lots of men wearing female avatars, you know, Beth, you may have a better knowledge of the stats than me, but in my class of 80 people, the conservative estimate is the amount of sexual behavior in there is more than half. The probably more accurate is around 3/4. And you know, there's a lot of men having sex with women, and they probably know on some level it's not a woman, but you know.
But also the Reeves and Nass stuff about in what way does it matter?
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to talk about that at all?
In terms of
our perception of simulation, we can't necessarily distinguish between the simulated and the real, which in some ways speaks to on what level.
Yeah, sure. We are, as Byron likes to say these days, is that we have not evolved to differentiate the digital from the physical. So there's a certain automated response that we get when a couple cylinders are fired, when that we just go with it.
Perception and morality in general, not just in this particular
case? You know, if you're talking perception, this can be a big debate, but there is no reality. So when I have vision, I'm transforming you from 3D to 2D. I'm processing colors in a way that all of us see colors differently. I mean, there's always, all perception is active, not passive, right? So I get hung up on those words. But what was your point? I'm sorry.
My point was that whatever your perception is your reality,
yeah,
that
you're
living
agree.
On. And this is just one of the examples. So,
Absolutely.
To me, it's like going into Second Life is like going to a play, except that, I mean, but there's a suspension of disbelief, but the degree to which everything can be manipulated is so far removed that it messes with the whole suspension of disbelief.
Yeah,
it changes that whole equation.
I mean, another way to think about it is you go to a play, but you don't go to a play for 20 hours a week. New data just came out from the Kaiser Family Foundation. It came out 2-3 days ago. Kids use digital media for over 8 hours per day, not counting the school stuff. Stunning, really well-run study. I recommend you read it. It's.
I'm curious, unrelated though. I mean, all of this is with a very relatively high-quality 3D stuff in goggles, where a lot of that kids' media is very cartoony. It's when you're going to step back from the weed. You still see similar effects.
Absolutely. So I've got a whole other line of studies that just look at, this gets back to your question about, so the dimensions on which you can parse virtual humans, photographic realism, which is how much does it look just like me versus cartoony, anthropomorphism, meaning is it a human-like or is it a walking tree, and behavior realism, how good are the animations, and lots of studies really parsing all of those. If I had to choose one and which causes the most social influence or the most presence, I would go with behavior. So it's much better that it look. If I'd rather have realistic movements and it looks like a cartoon. So there's obviously, we've all heard of the uncanny valley, which is when things look so real that it disturbs you. The five empirical studies on the uncanny valley, maybe there's 10, there's five, I think, that are decent. All of them show that you get uncanny valley when your photographic realism outstrips your behavioral realism. So what makes Pixar brilliant, they don't make their characters look highly photographically realistic because they know their animations aren't there yet. And why did Cameron's movie look so good? Because he spent, of his $300 million, 180 of them were spent on tweaking motion capture and really going through and making that work. And he's one of the first people to really be able to pull off as realistic a human as he could.
Is there any research about how much time someone needs to be immersed in order to sort of get
The longitudinal study is one that we should be running every study we run that gets run less than 1% of the time because it's difficult and expensive. I email me, I'll send you the two that we've done, but there's no answer to that. I mean, all the effects that we show, a very small exposure causes these effects, but we know that the 90-second exposure has got to be, from a procedural standpoint, different than the 20-hour-a-week exposure. We know that, but if I'm being a cheerleader for my work, what I say is that if you get these effects in 90 seconds, what happens when you get them 20 hours a week? But you know, it could be a totally different process. Again, there's a couple studies. What I am excited about is that I told you about the IARPA grant that just came out about your digital footprint. Rita Bush, who runs their division now, she's coming up with a very large call that's just based on when virtual turns into real behavior, and she's only accepting proposals that are going to go into longitudinal studies. So if it's not a longitudinal study, you can't apply. So she started to think about that, but not enough. Yeah, we need to do more work on that.
Have you ever tested in terms of the studies that deal with empathy? Have you ever tested people that do empathetic things for a living, say, as opposed to just random graduate students? You know, people that are in professions where empathy is a part of what they do. Actors, for example.
That's a great idea. We haven't done that. Mel Slater from he's now at Barcelona, was at University College London. Who's one of the main figures in VR research over the decades. He's done studies with actors. Anytime you ask about special populations, you lose 99% of your social science at that point. But he's done studies with actors doing just that, looking at how they look at empathy. And a punchline of the research isn't coming to mind, but I can certainly email you the papers, or you just go to his webpage and look at that. I think that's a great idea. I mean, especially towards training. I mean, certainly with the soldiers that we're training with the military stuff, these aren't just random people. But it's a good way to think about it. Mel Slater, Slater. He's got all stuff on him.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, guys. You guys have been awesome. Fantastic.